From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Memory is potent, powerful, pliable. We all know the view that says don't duck it, deal with it, work through. But new science is also holding up the value of forgetting. We're built to do it, they say. Sometimes we might be better off. This hour on Point, memory and forgetting. You can join the conversation. Was Tony Soprano right? Sometimes we should just forget about it. Does that sound healthy? Can we really do it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from New York is Ingrid Wickelgren. She's an editor at Scientific American and author of a special report in the current issue of Scientific American Mind titled Forgetting is Key to a Healthy Mind. Ingrid Wickelgren, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Why is it key?
Well, people have long, you know, revered superior memory. And, you know, most people assume that this sort of entails successfully stuffing the brain with lots of information and keeping it there. And forgetting, you know, even among psychologists was sort of almost a bad word, right? You don't you don't want to lose that information. But it turns out that forgetting, it turns it's sort of the it's very important to how we think and to mental health, because our brains really can't keep holding on to everything. It's not possible. So forgetting, it helps us, for one thing, sort of make sense of the world by clearing a path to the thoughts that are truly valuable. It's sort of like when you have a house that's filled with clutter and you can't find what's important because you have too much stuff in the way. You want to get rid of that stuff. The other side of it is that it helps us sort of emotionally often to forget. In the movie Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Kate Winslet plays a character called Clementine, who has a falling out with her boyfriend, Joel. And she just has
Jim
him erased.
Yes, right.
And, you know, in the movie, they have this fictitious technology to erase her mind. But remarkably, psychologists have found that we can actually do this. They've discovered a type of willful forgetting or intentional forgetting, and they've even sketched out a neural circuit underlying this ability. So, and, you know, the emerging data actually provides some of the first scientific support for Freud's theory of memory repression. In that theory, unwanted memories are sort of shoved into the subconscious. So we can sort of do this. And, you know, the other part of this is that our ability to forget, to suppress, that's the modern word for the repression, is something that goes along with various personality traits and even some aspects of intelligence. So it's sort of our ability to forget kind of says a lot about us.
Now, my sort of everyman understanding of Freud was that he was telling us, don't shove your memories, don't shove your experiences down into the subconscious. They'll just come back and bite you.
Right.
That forgetting wasn't helpful because you wouldn't really do it. You'd just submerge it and it would be working, you know, corrosively on you, your psyche anyway.
Right. So, exactly, you know, whether these memories that we can successfully sort of put into the background, put into subconscious, at least on a temporary basis, whether they eventually may come back to haunt us is still sort of unclear. But what is clear is that in many cases, actually dredging up those memories to sort of have them stick there, and you know, lots of people just can't get them out of their mind and they ruminate on them. And rumination is a risk factor for depression. So for some people, you know, I think dredging up those memories is sort of, it's not, it may not be such a good idea.
So are you presenting this kind of picture of intelligent people who have the personality or the mind to do it, sort of whacking off memories here and there that aren't helpful to them and surging forward as these high-performing, unencumbered people, and others ruminating and being dragged down into depression? It's sort of like forget, and you'll be the more successful. I guess on the one hand, we can see that. There must be some happy medium here, though, that we're not just sort of ignorant, foolish, happy warriors.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, there, of course, there are some things we have to deal with. If there's a problem that's going to be recurring, we need to think about it and find a solution. But the ability to shut these things out when it's useful is a good thing. It's a good thing to have, I think. And, you know, they've found one of the interesting things is that people with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder have trouble, shutting these memories out. And it's very interesting, actually, because not only are they sort of letting these distracting thoughts come into their mind, which is part of their issue, but it goes along with the hyperactivity as well, because the same brain circuit that is responsible for kind of blocking the memories is also responsible for blocking inappropriate behaviors. So
interesting.
It's interesting, yeah.
So those memories pile up and sort of get in their way of effective or comfortable functioning. And the new science here is about this capacity for willful forgetting. Ingrid Wilkegren is with us from New York and Scientific American. We have one of the scientists right in the forefront of this research with us right now from Cambridge, England. Michael Anderson joins us. He's a senior researcher at the school's Memory Control Lab, where he's been conducting experiments on the brain's capacity to forget on purpose. Michael Anderson, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Hi, Tom.
What have you learned about what we are capable of?
Well, I think when what we've studied is people's ability to stop memory, to put it succinctly. So what we've learned is that when people confront a reminder to something that they would rather not think about, something either unpleasant or uncomfortable, or even it's just something that's distracting you at the moment and you'd rather not think about it, people can and do shut down memory retrieval. They can say, stop, I'm not going to think about that now, and redirect their attention towards more profitable thoughts. And what's interesting is in focusing on exactly that specific situation, we've identified how people do it. What are the mechanisms involved? And there are costs involved with that are incurred as a result of shutting down a memory. It becomes harder to recall that memory later on when you want it. That's the essential lesson, is that stopping retrieval willfully can cause deficits in memory.
But you've got a kind of a celebratory stance toward this, discovering that we're capable of willful forgetting. You say it can direct us toward more profitable thoughts. Does it make us, I don't know, more one, two-dimensional people? Are we gaining by those forgotten, you know, those acts of forgetting? Or are we diminishing ourselves?
I think it would be too simple to say that that it's one thing or the other, right? Mm-hmm. I think it has its role. So we're all familiar with the idea of forgive and forget, right? And healthy relationship with somebody involves a certain amount of forgetting of their transgressions and unpleasant and annoying things that they've done.
But right in that phrase, the forgive part is also an active engagement with those acts. Before you forget about them, the forgiving is the dealing with them. But I hear you, read you writing, hey, we can just sit plain, forget about it, as Tony Soprano says.
Well, it's not as though it happens instantaneously. It's something that requires effort over time, and it's good that it does happen in some cases. But I also believe, just as you were saying, actually, that you don't want to run away from the lessons of experience. You know, there some negative things happen to us, and they have a place in our lives, and we have to think about them and process them and integrate them with who we are. But not everything fits that description, and to be able to remember everything unpleasant that's ever happened to us is definitely doesn't serve us.
From your research, I gather that different individuals have different capacities for this willful forgetting. Some do it with scarcely even thinking about it. They do it sort of automatically, clearing the decks, editing, winnowing. Yes. Others have to deal with memories piling up. What's the difference?
I think the difference lies in a construct that's known as cognitive control, which is basically attention. People vary naturally in this. Some people have very good focused attention abilities, and others are more distractible. You know, we know people like this. And what we're doing when we're shutting down memory is, in essence, trying to ignore or suppress that experience. And that's part of attention. And so people with deficits in attention will be less good at this.
Ingrid, you write that for some people this just comes naturally. I mean, for all of us, we do it in some way. We can't remember everything all the time, but some people just clear their field naturally without thinking twice about it, Ingrid.
Yes, I mean, this ability just, I think it just varies greatly. And you know, one of the things that I found really interesting about this work is that the various sort of intellectual capacities, such as, you know, the ability to do mental calculations, which is part of this front part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex,
mm-hmm.
It goes along with this ability to suppress memories. And it correlates actually with – it sort of correlates nicely with various studies. Mike has found that young, you know, people who have poorer, executive function in this part of the brain have more trouble forgetting. Similarly, as this function declines as you age, older people do too. So both children and elderly people have more trouble in forgetting tasks.
Unforgettable in every way. And forevermore, that's how you'll stay. That's why, darling, it's incredible that someone so unforgettable thinks that I am unforgettable too.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about memory and forgetting, and new research that says certain kinds of forgetting are very important to a healthy mind. Ingrid Wilkegren is with us from Scientific America, and she wrote the article, Forgetting is Key to a Healthy Mind, for Scientific American Mind. She writes the Streams of Consciousness blog at scientificamerican.com. Dr. Michael Anderson is with us for a few minutes here from the University of Cambridge in England, co-author of more than 30 research papers on cognition and brain science. Right in the middle of all this, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind came up, the 2004 Jim Carrey movie, and you've got Joel Barish there. He's playing, pays a company to erase all of the memories of his relationship with a former girlfriend. Here's a scene where a doctor played by Tom Wilkinson explains to Joel, Jim Carrey, what the procedure will be like.
There's an emotional core to each of our memories, and when you eradicate that core, it starts its degradation process. And by the time you wake up in the morning, all the memories we've targeted would have withered and disappeared, as in a dream upon waking.
Is there any risk of brain damage?
Well, technically speaking, the procedure is brain damage, but it's on a par with a night of heavy drinking. Nothing you'll miss.
On a par with a night of heavy drinking? Don't worry about it. People are fascinated with this as a CBS cop drama, Unforgettable. Actress Poppy Montgomery there plays Detective Carrie Wells, a detective who has total recall, which is great for helping solve cases, but causes problems in her personal life because she can't let go of the past. Here's a little bit where she's arguing with her partner, ex-boyfriend, Lieutenant Burns, played by Dylan Walsh, about who ended their relationship.
You left me, by the way.
That's right. It's because I'm an obsessive cataloger of people's faults who store sights and injuries like some kind of freak bulldog who will never let go unless you forcibly break her grip.
I never said that.
August 14th, 2002, 2:36 a.m., hot night, no rain. There were crickets.
Okay, now we got that out of the way.
There were crickets, but sometimes all that knowing is just too much. Let's get a caller right here from New York, Williamsville, New York. David's calling. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, and I'll dive right in.
Yeah.
I was a switchboard operator at a hospital.
Okay.
I am blind, mm-hmm. and I was very poor at retrieving information from the computer that spoke to me.
Yeah.
So I memorized over 400 numbers.
Okay.
Now, once I discontinued working there, those numbers evaporated.
That is interesting. Just gone.
I had sequences for cardiac arrests.
Yeah.
I had sequences for fires, multiple areas. And once I stopped working, it's been about 2 or 3 years.
Yep.
They disappeared.
I guess we can all relate to this, but it's such a vivid demonstration of something. Dr. Anderson, in England, you're listening here. You get the story. What is going on there scientifically?
Well, I mean, it's a really good example, David. It's the kind of thing, it's a situation in which forgetting is adaptive, in which it's not due to emotional reasons that you want to forget it, but rather because it's confusing or distracting or interfering. So a classic example of this would be you've changed banks or you've changed telephone numbers and you go to type in your bank code or you go to dial somebody's telephone number and it's their old telephone number and you go, you know, I don't need that anymore. Or what's their new number? And the struggle to recall the new number instead of the old number is where the forgetting happens. It's like you push aside that which you no longer need so that you can now remember what you do need.
So are you saying this was deliberate, or does this something in the prefrontal cortex, the executive function here, just decide involuntarily on David's behalf, done with that, don't need it, it's out of here?
What is deliberate is the effort to, usually is the effort to recall the current, relevant, new information. And often in the course of that, irrelevant information comes to mind. And it's that in that brief moment where you say, no, that's not what I want, and you reject it.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the forgetting happens.
David, from that experience, do you find, having exercised all that memory for 400 numbers, six ways to Sunday in your hospital switchboard job, Do you think you have a particularly good memory? Oh, he's gone. Well, we'll just have to wonder about that. Let's get one more. Katie here in Rockport, Massachusetts. Katie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling because I feel like I have a very good memory, and especially it's shown up in that I can remember events from when I was very young, before I was 2 years old. Is there any significance as far as that kind of memory?
People who can remember very early things in life. Dr. Anderson?
I mean, that's within the normal range of variability. I mean, there's a typical period in your early childhood. It ranges anywhere from, say, 1 or 2 years of age until about 5 or 6 years of age. It's called infantile amnesia. It's very normal for people to not remember that. It just sounds like you have a particularly early window. It's just that you have very good memory.
Here, Sarah asks online, Dr. Anderson, is there a scientific difference between men and women regarding memory?
I suppose I would say that one of the general differences between men and women, and I should emphasize that this is in the aggregate, it's not going to be true of everyone, is that men tend to be more spatial and women tend to be more verbal. And this also tends to show up in memory as well. But on the whole, I wouldn't say that men or women have superior memory across the board.
Though in terms of this forgetting business, I think at least in the U.S., I think there's a kind of social stereotype out there of women dwelling on things versus men sort of saying, let it go. Could that be related to memory, or am I just, you know, being a stereotyping guy?
There's the getting it in, and then there's the keeping it out, right? So I think the getting it in part is what we're talking about here, is like storing new experiences in memory, the capacity to do that either spontaneously or willfully. And I don't think that men and women differ along that. But, you know, if you tend to be somebody who doesn't want to dwell on the past or want to just shut that down, and that's your way of dealing with it, it could be that there's a gender difference there, but I don't know of any evidence documenting that.
Another listener online says, I heard somewhere that memory was linked to migraines, which would make sense to me, this listener writes. Doctor?
I'm afraid I don't know too much about that.
What's the difference between, or how would you describe, I guess, the difference between good forgetting and bad forgetting? I mean, we all know we don't want memories that are so bad we can't keep track of what's going on in our own lives. We don't want dementia. We don't want that kind of memory loss. But, you know, how do you decide when it's good to shove something out of your mind because it frees you up to do new things or think anew versus when it's just kind of denial and ducking and not dealing with something that you ought to be dealing with?
Well, I should say that I'm... In my work, I don't try to necessarily pass judgment on whether or not this is always a good thing to do. I really mainly study how do people do it when they do, and believe me, they do it. But I would say that even things that are at one moment not good to think about, at a later moment, they might be something that you want to think about. And
mm-hmm.
In which case, you know, like, for example, maybe you decide to deal with your problems and go into therapy, in which case having a bad memory for all the terrible things that have happened to you isn't maybe the best thing. To pick an example, a paramedic, people who work in professions in which they routinely have to deal with unpleasant experiences,
mm-hmm.
a paramedic, a doctor in an emergency room, what have you, I've spoken to these people, I've given lectures in front of groups of people like this, and they'll tell you, geez, I do that all the time. And if I couldn't do that, I couldn't get by.
Do you have a sense from your research of what percentage of the population is good at healthy forgetting? What forgets too much? What is plagued by things they can't forget? And, you know, what portion of the population kind of sits in some happy medium?
No hard statistics on anything like that. That kind of work hasn't been done. But I would say that certainly the people who have difficulties with chronic intrusive memories of unpleasant experiences are probably going to be a smaller fraction of the population. So if you look at studies of post-traumatic stress disorder in the aftermath of some traumatic event, everybody, it's normal for everybody initially to have intrusions and flashbacks and nightmares after something like that. But over time, for most people, the frequency of those intrusions decreases systematically. But what's interesting is that it varies from person to person what that rate is. And for some people, the intrusions never go away. And so that's chronic post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's clearly a problem. If those intrusive memories are undermining their capacity to cope in day-to-day life, then that's a serious issue.
Kestrel writes to us online, "I wonder if this exemplifies a certain personality type. I'm the kind of person," she writes, "who lives very much in the present/future. I hardly ever think about the past. I just put it out of my mind." And then this, it's interesting, she writes, "it makes forgiveness easier." What do you say, Dr. Anderson?
It's true. I mean, there's actually published work on this, like relating the capacity to forgiveness to forgetting. And there's recently, I forget who did it, but there's a couple of publications on it, and it does seem to be a real observation.
Dr. Michael Anderson at the University of Cambridge, the Memory Control Lab, their professor and senior scientist there joining us today. Thank you so much for your research and for your time today.
Ah, you're welcome, Tom.
Ingrid, where do you fall on the spectrum of capacity for healthy forgetting, do you think, Ingrid? Have you self-assessed?
Well, yeah, I have thought about this, and I wish that I knew. I would like to take one of Mike Anderson's think-no-think tests, which is sort of how you measure this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think I am somewhere in the middle, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I do notice that, you know, there are people, you know, my husband in particular, who seem to fit the profile of somebody who may forget easily, at least about certain things.
Is he blithe spirit? Is that his profile?
No, I wouldn't say that. But about certain things that I may sort of think about a little longer, he won't let me talk about them. He'll say, "No, we're not talking about that." And sort of move on, right? And at the same time, I notice that mm-hmm. one of the things he's really good at is very quickly sifting through large bodies of information to get the point, the central, you know, thesis of something. And I feel that I'm a little more detail-oriented.
Yeah.
So it may be that I don't forget really easily. At the same time, it's interesting because I feel that maybe I've gotten better at this over time, maybe in part through implicit encouragement from my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And also I remember when I was little sort of ruminating on things. And at one point I sort of had this insight and I talked to myself and I said, "You don't have to think about that anymore." I gave myself permission
right.
to stop thinking about it. Yes,
yeah.
I remember telling myself that. And, you know, and it had helped. So, and there's some data that suggests you can get better at this.
Maybe sometimes purging would be good for acquiring the new. This is so interesting. Ingrid, stand by. Ingrid Wilkegren in New York. Allison Winter joins us right now from Chicago. She's a historian at the University of Chicago, specializes in the history of understanding the mind, author of the new book, Memory, Fragments of Modern History. Allison Winter, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Trying to figure this out. I mean, there's lots of angles to it. Part of it goes back to what we think of is what Freud told us. You know, don't try to repress or bury this stuff. It's just going to come back and bite you. Don't try and forget. You can't really do that and be healthy. Is that insight in conflict with what we're hearing today, Allison? What's the evolutionary path of thinking about memory and forgetting and mental health?
I'd say yes and no. The basic idea of repression was that it served an immediate healthful purpose. Mm-hmm. That is, memories that were too painful, too obstructive to a person's ability to function in the moment were repressed. But then there was the long-term significance of suppressing something with great emotional significance. And Freud's idea and that of classical psychoanalysis was that you couldn't keep things repressed entirely. They would find their way out in some other way, such as a psychologically caused disease.
Right.
And then at that point, the way to address those problems was to bring the memories back, address them, and in the context of treatment for hysteria or some related psychologically caused disorder, the more you remembered, the better.
So is this still considered good science, or has Tony Soprano got it now? Just let it go. Forget about it. Done.
Well, it's certainly an enormous change that we're being invited to take part in, I think, in thinking about the healthy mind. I'm sure there are many therapists out there who would be appalled by the idea of doing what that wonderful song from the musical, The Book of Mormon, says, turn it off, you know, because I think that there are lots of therapists who are still working from a loosely psychoanalytic framework in which you're supposed to confront the past, work through it, and the mark of a healthy mind is the mastery of your past, the conscious mastery of your past. So you still remember everything. You can just deal with it. But I think there's other traditions that also that chime with this research that Michael Anderson is doing now. For one thing, there's 75 or so years of memory research that indicates that memories aren't stable anyway. So every time we remember mm-hmm. something, we change it. Mm-hmm. And although that work did not focus on deliberately changing our memories in order to have a healthier mind, there's a potential common ground there between the cognitive psychologists who've shown that memories change. They don't just stay fixed in our unconscious forever. And the idea that you could manage your memories by deliberately getting rid of them.
Boy, this sounds like a tough one for a layperson to straddle, you know, dive in, deal with your memories, conscious mastery of the past versus not only let it go, but it really just wipe it out, wipe the slate, forget it.
Well, it's certainly confusing. And one of the amazing things about the situation right now is that different fields of scientists who study the mind who used to never even talk to one another because they were based in different kinds of assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
The neuroscientists, the therapists who came out of the psychoanalytic tradition, or the cognitive psychologists who did experiments in labs, they never talked to one another before. But there seems to be so much potential common ground and connections in really unlikely ways.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about memory and forgetting. And new research that says certain kinds of forgetting are actually very important to a healthy mind. We've been joined by Ingrid Wilkegren. She's an editor at Scientific American, writes the blog Streams of Consciousness at scientificamerican.com. Allison Winter is with us right now from Chicago, the University of Chicago. Her new book, forthcoming book, is Memory, Fragments of a Modern History. We've thought about it in many different ways over time. 800-423-8255 is our number. And Bonnie's calling from Centerville, Massachusetts. Bonnie, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I used to work in an ER. I'm a nurse. And it was very important for us to literally dump our memory banks every day before we came back in. Because we had such an onslaught of input for each 10 or 12 hours we spent there,
yeah,
that you couldn't possibly hold on to all of that and be effective.
And you find yourself literally pushing memories out of your mind?
Well, we talked about it. It was more a process of just letting go of it, you mm-hmm. know, not dwelling on it. One of the things about working in an ER is you don't really find out what happens to everyone after they leave.
Right.
And that was the most frustrating thing at the beginning, because you wanted to know, yeah, well, how did this person do when they went to the floor?
Yeah.
But you couldn't follow up on all that, so you really had to dump it and start again the next day.
Bonnie, I'm glad you mastered that. Ingrid, does this sound like an example of the willful forgetting that we're hearing about?
Yeah, you know, and I would say that it's probably the case that people who can work in an ER may be the sorts of people who are naturally better at suppressing these memories that mainly only disturb you as opposed to being useful for future problem solving, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would gather that not everybody could do that and not everybody could work in an ER.
But if you can, maybe that's your ticket to ride, as John Huntsman has it these days. Bonnie, thanks for that. Andy in Frankfort, Kentucky. You're on the air, Andy.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I wanted to share a quote that I kind of remembered and looked up for this occasion by Friedrich Nietzsche mm-hmm. about forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "It is possible to live almost without remembering, indeed to live happily, as the beast demonstrates. However, it is completely and utterly impossible to live at all without forgetting." And he goes on to say that there is a degree of insomnia of rumination through which something living comes to harm and finally perishes, whether it is a person or a people or a culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just always kind of thought that, and so I've really enjoyed this conversation about it, that basically the idea is if you can't forget, you can't move on to the next thing, you can't change, and all the world is change, and rather than stagnating in the past, you got to move on.
Andy, bless you. I'm so glad you brought that up. A lot of people are thinking of Nietzsche as we talk about this today. It is really interesting. Allison, I'm going to bring this to you because I was also got online here. Steve writes this great topic, and he wants to talk about, you know, Nietzsche's work on the subject in the use and abuse of history, where he outlines, as our caller from Kentucky does, the importance of forgetting or the importance of living unhistorically. Also in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Nietzsche writing, "Beware that a statue does not slay you." Steve says it's like a metaphor to deal with life. A statue is like a memory, inanimate, dead, only has power if you choose to look in its direction. But on the other hand, we've got a listener online, Alice, and Toyota says, "Do we need to forget or do we need to just learn Zen? Memory is useful because it allows us to recognize we are in a rut. Zen instructs us that the pain we get from memory is really an alarm clock to stay present." It feels like two different angles on this, Allison.
Yes. The callers and commenters who brought up the discussions of the importance of forgetting made me think about what an enormous change it is to value forgetting and not to cling to the idea of a masterful memory as a big change historically. If you think not just of the last 100 years, but the last couple of thousand,
okay,
a masterful memory, well, you don't need to, but okay. but if you just cast just imagine the last couple thousand years.
All right.
A masterful memory, being in command of absolutely everything that you learn, was the mark of a competent and clever person. But in the 19th and the 20th century, the last couple hundred years, that idea of intelligence, I think not only for an individual, but for a community, shifted. So certainly for an individual mind, forgetting became something, or at least not remembering, became something that was fully compatible with cleverness. And in fact, somebody who could remember absolutely everything that they'd ever read was a pedant and wasn't able to prioritize. So the quote from Nietzsche is really telling as a marker of how our cultures have changed in the modern, you know, in the modern day.
You know, if you look back 2,000 years and you see that master of memory as a mark of kind of greatness, I mean, there's another sort of contemporary, I don't know, model or meme that at the other end of the spectrum that can be off-putting, the sort of, you know, free agent who just moves and forgets and moves and profits and moves again and profits again, a kind of expedient, soulless, memory-free actor, Allison.
Absolutely. That's the flip side of it. But I think that what Michael Anderson is talking about is the judicious dumping of memories that are unimportant or unhealthful. And so the key distinction would be that a wise person, the mark of a wise person would be the ability, would have the ability to discriminate between the important memories and the unimportant ones. And that's the big change from the distant past where say, somebody who was able to recite every word of the Bible mm-hmm. was a clever person.
Ingrid, how do you know when it's a judicious dumping of memory and not just, you know, a radical evasion of what you've lived or avoiding the Zen alarm clock of memory?
Well, you may not. It may be a hard choice in some cases, but I think that in cases where you really feel that the memory is, I mean, sometimes you just know this is not something I'm going to be able to solve. And it's distracting me. It's upsetting me. And what I really need to be doing is something else. You know, one of the things that inspired me, I think, a little bit to write this article mm-hmm. Came from my own past. My dad was a cognitive psychologist.
Okay.
He studied learning and memory. And like many people, he loved reading the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
But unlike many of us who sort of feel like we should read the newspaper to keep up on current events, my dad felt guilty about reading the newspaper. And
why?
It sounds a little – well, because he felt that he was cluttering his brain with stuff that might interfere with the core things in his life that he thought were the most important, which were his work and, luckily for us, his children.
So he had some intuition of this kind of insight that you need to actually scrape off some barnacles too.
Yes. So when I heard about this work, I think it sort of resonated with me a little bit from my childhood. My father, you know, was not somebody who tended to think like everybody else. So mm-hmm. he, you know, this was something that I don't, you know, it just kind of made me, you know, inspired me, I guess, a little bit to explain some of the things he said to us. So.
A little premonition right there. Let me go to Joe in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello. Yeah. This is great, great, great stuff. I'm wondering about some techniques.
Like, how do you do it? You mean how to forget if you want to forget?
I'm into yoga, and I'm into the Zen.
Okay.
Yoga certainly helps me, but I tend to ruminate about stuff that I would have wished I'd done or not done.
Right.
And how... Do we work on that? And talking about news, I try not to read the newspaper because of so much bad stuff. And I know thoughts create feelings. Feelings create emotions. Emotions create actions. So I'm aware of all this stuff. But how do we do any specific techniques for working on that?
Well, let us pick it up. Ingrid, here's Joe. He's got the discipline, does his yoga, does his Zen. What's the discipline of forgetting? How does he do it? How's it work, Ingrid?
Right. So, this experimental forgetting that they've studied has not been completely refined for clinical use. So for one thing, they don't know exactly what people are doing when they say, don't think about this association. You know, the cue that brings up the bad memory and they say, don't think about it. People, they're not entirely sure what people are doing. But one sort of idea is they just sort of try, right, to let it go. And I know that seems incredibly vague. And as I said before, some people are better at this than others. And another thing that they have found
But may I just pause you there for a moment? When you say let it go, I'm not sure if that means let go of the emotion around a memory or let go of the memory itself, even erase the memory itself. Which?
So when oftentimes what happens is something in your environment is a cue for a memory mm-hmm. that's not so good. So you go to the same place that you had the last date with your, you know, yeah. with your ex-boyfriend yeah. or something, right? And so, I mean, one option, obviously, is to not go to that place. But you could also try, and one technique is to try, you know, when you go to a place like that, is to deliberately try and replace that with something else. So if you see some sort of prop at a party, like a lei, and it reminds you of, you know,
Hawaii and Pearl Harbor or a bad affair.
Right. You know, maybe you want to replace that with a nice beach vacation or something, okay. you know, or, you know, something that helps. And what they've shown is that for people who are depressed or who are prone to depression, who can't just shut it out, whatever that means, that replacing an association, you know, that something that cues something else with a something different. So the cue brings up something else, sort of deliberately replacing this, mm-hmm. The bad thought with a better one, is more successful for them. So, mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing is that if you have something specific that you want to forget, just try stopping it repeatedly. Practice, at least in these experiments, does improve your ability to forget specific memories.
Yoga Joe, there's some things you can work on. Maybe just step away from the cue, step away from the memory. On the other hand, we don't want to be zombies. Lynn in Newport News, Virginia. Lynn, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. I'm a clinical neuropsychologist, and I have only heard parts of this program, mm-hmm. But I wanted to make a couple of observations or comments.
Please.
First of all, I think that memory and forgetting, and whether it's good to remember or good to forget, good to work through the past or let it go, certainly is going to vary from individual to individual, and is going to be determined largely upon not only what's happened in the past, but what the current situation and status of the individual are. So that there is still a place for a whole range of types of psychotherapies, for example.
Mm-hmm.
My second comment is that while it was mentioned that different disciplines are communicating better today than they used to about cognitive neuroscience and human emotion, et cetera, there's still just a gigantic gap, and there's a lot of rediscovering the wheel going on where, for example, in medicine, there will be a discovery, so to speak, of something that has long been demonstrated in clinical psychology or neuropsychology.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow.
But are you comfortable with this sort of laudatory notion of forgetting, Lynn, as a neuropsychologist, or does it bother you?
Well, I think there's a place for it, mm-hmm. but I think it's not for everyone. And it's not only is it not possible for everyone, but it may not be the most helpful thing for everyone. Certainly our memories are very instructive. And if we don't learn something from our experiences, that can be problematic too. And that includes things that may have been traumatic in the past.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I really do think it's a very individual issue as to whether even the last caller who was talking about ruminatory behaviors,
mm-hmm.
That's a little bit different issue than, for example, reliving a past trauma or PTSD-type symptoms.
Yeah, where it's vivid and it's suddenly all over your brain and you can't deal sometimes. Lynn, our time is so short, but I'm really grateful for your call right there. Allison, here's also a listener online giving us that historical perspective, saying a half century ago, Walter J. Freeman, who developed the therapeutic value of lobotomy, said, quote, "A good forgettery is as important as a good memory." On the other hand, today, Allison, I mean, we wouldn't vote for lobotomies. But the sort of right balance here, I'm imagining listeners are going to go away wondering what it is, how much to let go of, how much to hang on to. What's the state of the sort of arc of understanding there? You're a historian, Allison.
Well, I certainly don't think that anyone would vote for the lobotomy solution. That period when lobotomies were developed was also a really interesting time for memory research, because that was the same period when the hippocampus was identified as the place where memories were recalled. Mm-hmm. About how much to remember and how much to forget, I think that one of the consequences of the coming together of different fields, to whatever extent it's happening, and I'm sure that the previous caller is right that it's that there are enormous gaps between what different fields know. To whatever extent it can happen, I would imagine that it would be an important thing to do. For instance, Dr. Anderson's research on forgetting doesn't focus on real memories. That's something that remains to be examined. And
it's sort of laboratory memory experiments, rather, that he's on to there. With that, I'm afraid we're out of time, but he's on to something clearly important with that, Allison, that he's saying has its echo in our very real memories. Gee, I could do this for another hour, but we're out of those hours. Allison Winter at the University of Chicago, author of the forthcoming memory, Fragments of Modern History. Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
And Ingrid Wilkegren at Scientific American, scientificamerican.com. Thanks for joining us, Ingrid.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Listeners, don't forget, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.